Remember, guys, Southside Lectures 25 years ago when Dee and Bowman and some of the other guys, and they'd all get up one after the other and just praise each other, the great preaching job they've done. Remember that? I'm going to do it now. This man has got what it takes. Then, this is, we can see your heart. We can see the truth that you're presenting. I could listen to you as well all day. So thank you for what you do. Absolutely terrific. So this session is about what on earth goes on when people experience change. Whether that's in their everyday lives or whether that's in a therapy office because they're dealing with the deep wounds that we're talking about. Well, remember this? All this stuff. Let me actually move on to the... Oh, there we go. Sorry. Did it wrong. Oh, well. Why can't I back up? Chuck?
I put you in the wrong slide.
No, let's see. Oh, there we go. Okay. Okay, so the last slide we left off with, it was just half the job. It's that when that therapist, came in to happens. Well, okay, so I'll just give you a snapshot. There's a lot of stories. Everybody's, in a sense, different because there's different details, but it all comes down almost every single time to the basics of what you learned before. And by the way, you've got to understand, this is what I see in my office practically every week, almost every day, for men primarily, although there's some, at least one teenage girl I'm working with, but as a matter of fact, they happen to be either adolescents from 15 to however old, boys and men. So just so you know what they're coming in with, I just wanted to give you a snapshot of who I know them to be. And a lot of those stories, again, go to voices-of-change.org because you'll find much more detail. But basically, I wanted to tell you that, for instance, I know a man who was sexually molested by a high school guy in a tent next to his home when he was 5. I know a guy who slept as a little boy for a couple of years in the sliver of space between the side of his bed and the wall because he was too afraid of his father and his mother. I know a man who was raped as a child by an older boy and never told anyone about it because he thought it was normal. I know a man who hates his male sexual organs. I know a man who is very effeminate but has no idea how to move on into healthy masculinity. I know a man who has been bullied, hit, shamed, called idiot, queer, faggot, and a whole host of the worst possible language you could ever imagine. I know a man who was never touched by his father in any way, unless it was a whipping, until he was 12. I know a man who was always happy, but wouldn't dream of ever telling anyone in the Church of Christ that he's having homosexual feelings, feeling shame and intense fear that he would be destroyed or abandoned or ridiculed if he revealed this. I know a woman whose grief is overwhelming for never being cherished by her own mother. I know a woman whose father wanted her to be a boy and told her he wished she was a boy when she was a little girl. I know a woman who was sexually abused for many years by her grandfather. I know a woman who had to take care of her mother's emotional needs and her emotional turmoil, so was made to be a parent while she lost being a little girl. I know a woman who was raped by members of her own family as a girl and adolescent who now hates men. And I know a woman who was shamed into being perfect all her early years, then crashed and burned as an adult. That's the kind of thing that these people, these folks are dealing with. That's what this, the kind of thing that when we get right down into the deep issues, that's what's going on. And again, I want to encourage you to know that just because you see a gay person running around, you don't have to pull out your Bible gun and shoot them. You got to know this about them. One reason why I believe they deserve, people with these issues specifically deserve so much compassion, it's only one reason, is because it's the mind of Christ. It's the heart of Christ. If I know this stuff, and if you know this stuff, don't you think that Christ knows exactly, much better than us, what these folks are going through? Actually, this is true for all people who are having really serious issues with their faith or emotions or psychological stuff. We need to start thinking like Christ and not just judging the surface. So compassion is the key. And I told you it was going to be about truth and compassion today. So, as we said before, boy is born. We're taking the boy model right now. A boy is born, growing male identity, designed by God, and boom, he experiences all this emotional upheaval, disidentification, not affirmed, not loved, affection, painful, all that stuff. No child can take that, and so the defense mechanisms start up, and he assumes that it's all about how bad he is. Did you know that? Children, unfortunately, are more prone to take on, I am the problem, I am bad if people reject me. The problem I see every time in my office. The defensive detachment from male identity starts on a deep core gender level, disown parts of themselves, and then there's that happy kind of false self on that. And when I come in, when authentic reparative therapy comes in, I move into to address, this is actually kind of a long process over a period of, depends on the person. Some people make great changes, 6 months, 2 years. Some are in therapy for, depending on how rough things were for them, 15 years or more. So there's no, you know, there's no one set answer. But how authentic reparative therapy works is, it's you don't have to remember this term, but just so you know, it's psychodynamic. And all that means is you go down below to the root causes, which are usually in childhood, and heal those, and then watch what happens on the top. So when we feel and deal with what's really going on, and when they can trust to reveal and to feel the stuff and to face the roadblocks, which these are roadblocks, then these disowned parts, they start to vanish. They start to go away. And layer by layer, they start to resolve these issues. Defensive detachment, especially, is one of them. So they can embrace their own sense of masculinity. Shame-based statements. Have to do a lot of work on shame-based statements. So those defense mechanisms basically are resolved. Long story short, those are resolved. And then what's after, when that goes, what's left over? It's right there. You see what these clients have to face when you remove all the roadblocks? They finally have to feel and deal with what's really going on. And sometimes the grief and anger that happens in the office and when they're able to fully express themselves more authentically in their everyday lives is tremendous. It's huge. But there's one advantage, especially when you take the shame or the inferiority away. They become more alive. They become more authentic because they're not shoving all that stuff down anymore. And then it has, like all grief work, works the same way with any kind of grief, really. At a certain point in time, the body takes a breath and one comes back up into what we call the assertive state or the authentic, real person instead of the happy or fake person. So that's the advantage. And so that's why we've got grief leads to assertion, or the authentic state. And then when that goes away, then a guy gets back to his unblocked growing male identity. And so all that dark stuff gets revealed. Right now it's turning blue. So that means it's life. So the shame self is into the assertive self. The healthy male self-esteem arises. And then this is the ultimate point for those people who come in to begin with. When we feel and deal and heal and resolve the underlying issues, what happens is when we go back to, let's say, somebody they were sexually attracted to of the same sex, in that moment and later on in their everyday lives because they've done so much emotional resolving work, homosexual feelings actually begin to dissipate, or at least lessen, automatically. Because we're dealing with what's really going on. And that's the theory, and that's what I see every day in my office. Can you imagine what it's like for a guy who's, let's say he isn't even a member of the church, and he comes to the office and he's finally able to get all of this stuff out, and we're finally able to end all this shame stuff just for feeling those things, and is able to grieve his losses, and he feels more powerful inside of his own body as a man. He's finally in touch with his healthy sense of masculinity, and he doesn't have to project that onto some idealized, erotic version of men anymore. And so he goes back to the picture, and sometimes I hear things like, I'm not attracted to him at all. I hear this in my office. And I say change is impossible. That's one way how it really happens. I hear things, a couple years ago I heard there were three different reparative therapy clients. They didn't know each other, and it just happened to be at the same time, and it was not solicited by me. They just spoke up one day, and I'm paraphrasing, but they basically said the same thing. They said, you know, David, this whole masculinity reparative therapy, I mean, this whole experience, this feels so much better than sex with guys. I know two things, given their honest feelings. It ain't inborn, and it's changeable. Now, how much change? That's a debate, of course. Some guys, let's face it, like all sins and feelings, sometimes, there's no shame for this, some guys still have some feelings, temptations left over. Some guys, the rest of their lives. The other extreme is, some guys who don't have those feelings at all, or virtually not at all. It just doesn't enter into the picture. So, and there's a continuum along those lines. It depends on a lot of things. It depends on how much they're able to work on their issues. It depends on the expertise of the therapist as well, of course. It depends on the magnitude of those wounds and how deep they were and how much abuse maybe they've gotten into. It depends on if they've been attracted to girls as well, because sometimes guys grow up and they're not attracted at all, but some of them are. And so there's a continuum there. But all I'm trying to say to you today is change in whatever degree that a boy or a man is able to do that is possible. Now, this is all about me, but sometimes I sit in my office and I see these guys, their relief and their change, and sometimes incredulity, and I watch them grow and change right in front of my eyes, and sometimes my mouth just drops open because I just see them back in line, in sync with how God designed them, according to their biological sex and what was intended for them emotionally and behaviorally and psychologically. And that's kind of why I do what I do. Sometimes people ask me, how on earth do you listen to all these problems all week long, year after year? It's just horrible stuff. It enlivens me. Maybe I was just meant to be this for people, but it's so amazing to me. It's just wonderful to see change. So, and a lot of these people, I could go on and on about spirituality too. Most of these people are people of faith, and obviously this helps them in at least some version of spirituality as well. All right, so the natural dissipation of homosexual feelings is possible. Also, close-knit male friends, which we're going to talk about more later on this afternoon. We'll talk about it more right now, but in a minute. But close male friends, if they haven't had that before, where they get affirmation, approval, and affection, that's what needs to happen as much as possible in their current everyday lives. Most men who walk into my office, they don't know what it's like to... they don't know what it feels like, really, to have a good male best friend. They've only heard somebody bully them. They don't know what it's like for... They don't know what it's like to never be touched by a father until they were 12, except for a whipping. They don't know what it's like to be able to hear from mom, "I'm so glad you're a man. What a great thing! I'm so glad you're growing up as a strong, powerful man, they don't hear stuff like that. They get parentified. They lose their childhoods. They don't have that experience as they were designed to experience. And so these issues are so prevalent, the behaviors that result as that, even though they do absolutely have free choice, nobody's making them choose anything. But I want to assure you, those feelings, just in case you were wondering, they don't choose these feelings. They choose their behavior. You've got to know that. You will look like a fool if you start to argue with somebody about that issue. These are automatic feelings that come up as a result of wounds. A gay activist will tell you they come up automatically because they were born that way. So don't try to convince somebody they choose these feelings. They choose their behavior. It's the same thing with all temptations. Okay. And then for a lot of men, especially those, which is kind of obvious, who have liked girls before to some extent, attractions for women develop because they're kind of back on track. Okay. So I believe that authentic reparative therapy actually reflects sound biblical principles. One of the reasons I believe that is because it gets rid of shame in a way that just happens to be reflective of biblical principle. I'm not saying therapy substitutes for the Bible at all. I'm saying it just happened. It wasn't created as a spiritual therapy. It just happened to be created by a man who was a person of faith, and it reflects that. One of the main ways that how it reflects that is, you would not believe the amount of guys that come into my office from 15 to, most of my clients now are from 15 to 29, but beyond that, sometimes in the 50s, and you would not believe what they consider to be righteous shaming that they're actually putting themselves through. So I want to stop and I want to explain what I mean by shame. Pretty much every time you hear me use the word shame today, I'm not talking at all about biblical guilt. The difference between guilt and shame is this, basically. The voice of guilt says there's something wrong with what I've done. Guilt is good. It doesn't feel good, but it's good for us. It keeps us from murdering people and robbing banks, right? So that's just the way it is. And it can feel horrendous, all right? And there's a way out of guilt, of course, as we know. The voice of shame says there's something wrong with me. But so much so, on my core level, I am inferior, with the added idea of I'll never be anything but inferior. I define myself as inferior. And there's no way out, and I'm unforgivable. Now, does that match, unless somebody's in the midst of actual sin and not, does that match biblical principles, that attitude that they come in with? So part of my work with them is to, especially those guys who want some spirituality in their sessions, is to help them realize that they're not even quoting the Bible accurately. They're believing things that are darkness about themselves. But some of them are confused because in their heads they know that, well, that's not true. It's not that I'm unforgivable, but they feel that way, and that's how they live their lives. So it's almost as though they are living that life that way. And they learn this kind of shame all the way back when they were 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, and all that. And it just continues on and on. So one of the first principles of real reparative therapy is get rid of any and all shame for having homosexual feelings. Now, important question. Are homosexual feelings sinful? I'm throwing it out.
No? How do you know? Prove it to me.
Anybody?
No, go ahead.
I'm a male, and I get feelings for females that I know God
Okay. Yeah, sure. But are homosexual feelings sinful? This is the same reaction I get in my office. Go ahead.
I don't feel that it is sinful. I feel like the act of doing it is sinful.
How do you know that from biblical perspective?
I would say what you just said. I mean, God put in us a natural man, a natural function to like women, to be attracted to women. That's a feeling. But when we are not married and we, you know, look at women and we look too long and we have a desire to go after that person, then I feel that's when sin comes in. But
yeah. I get it. Who else? Yep, right there.
In 1 Corinthians 6, 9, it has a list of things that is not accepted by God. And one of those homosexuality doesn't say those who desire of the same sex, but it says homosexuality is like, which is the act of participating.
Good, I think you're on the right track. I'm actually looking for a person. Can anybody, I'm going to make you dig for this, all right? Go back. Bingo.
The second one is Cain. He had bad feelings for his brother. He told sin couches at the door. He had sinned by feeling that way. He sinned when he acted on it.
You want to assist me in my office someday? That's what I have to tell these guys. And some of you may have a little problem with that, and I bet you $10, well, don't want to bet, but, you know, I would bet you anything practically that I know what you're going to say if this feels a little funny to you. But don't be afraid to speak up if there's something kind of weird for you right now. But that's right. The point is, and this is what I have to tell these guys in the office all the time, because some have never thought about it, because they're so inferiorized, so to speak. If temptation is the sin, then we're all lost. Because you just can't get around that verse that you just pointed out. Jesus was tempted in all points as we. I don't know exactly all the temptations, but would it matter? He lived a sinless life. So that's right. But these guys walk in living as though they believe they're sick and depraved and horrific and not Christian and horrible people because they have, and believe they're not men really, because they have that level of shame. That's what we're talking about. Does that make sense? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't bring up the Pharisees and Jesus. You know what I'm talking about? Because it's the same thing, basically. God, Jesus said what about men, the Pharisees who didn't have sex with women, but they developed what in their hearts? Lust. Jesus told them they sinned because they lusted in their hearts. So it's basically the same argument, right? Okay, you guys figure it out. What's the difference? You've got a verse over here where Jesus was tempted. Tempted. Desire. For something. And you've got a verse over here where it says, you know, that, what we just said. Yes, ma'am. Okay. The Bible says God lusted about some things. That's good, but... Yes, sir?
God knows what's in my heart, and He knows when I'm ready to act on what I'm entertaining in my heart.
Okay. Were those Pharisees acting on their lusts in their heart? They must have been, because you just condemned them for it.
God knows.
Yeah, and you're right. Ultimately, you're right. And Jesus knew who's God. Does that give you some clues on probably how to rightly divide some scripture here? I know these are my, I'm not going to say it, you know what I'm going to say, but go ahead. Yeah, and I think that's the point. I think that's actually the crux of the matter right there. It has to be in order for Scripture to be harmonized. The Pharisees were cherishing it in their heart, were they not? Lusting after these women, thinking they weren't breaking the law. Remember the verses? They evidently were proud of the fact that they could lust after a woman in their heart. They cherished that. They were active internally in their hearts. I don't think the other verses that were mentioned today about that, when it's just temptations, are anything but temptations. Now, I know that the line between the two can be a second. I get that. And as you said, that, you know, God judges our hearts. So we need to be careful in our hearts. I'm not saying at all that it's okay for any kind of lust for anything to you just sit there and go, wow, oh, great, cool, yeah. No, that's sinning in your heart, I think. But if you're tempted and you're going, oh, I'm so tempted by this, I'm worried I'm going to fall and all that, and there's a goodness of heart there. God knows our struggles. Isn't it like the man who prayed on the hill, I'm such a sinner, and God blessed him. So he's owning his stuff. There's a difference. We get into a lot of emotional and, I think, spiritual trouble when we tend to treat people as actually having sinned or horrible people, which is judgmentalism, only God judges, when we find out that they have temptations. It works with anything, does it not? What if one of you guys have a problem with, for whatever reason, have a problem with drinking alcohol? For some guys, it's really temptation, major temptation, even an addiction. Okay, so you got to get rid of that shame if you think that just being tempted is making you a horrible person, unworthy of forgiveness. Does that all make sense? If it doesn't, I want to make sure you guys understand me, because I don't want you going out of here thinking that, well, David Pickup, he says it's okay to, you know. Does anybody feel uncomfortable with that? Because I'm happy to talk about it. Okay, all right, some more questions? Okay. I'm not trying to say that reparative therapy is a magic pill. It's not. It's a lot of hard, tough work. It just is. Like most effective therapy. Marty said that. In therapy, this is what gay activists will swear up and down that doesn't happen in sessions. That's part of my personal mission in therapy, to have absolutely unconditional, positive agape or love for anybody who walks into my office. I stay out of judgmentalism. I just simply listen and hear people. And depending on what they want, we go through some emotional processes that get into some deep healing kind of stuff, and or we go through how they can circumvent their behaviors and live a better life. Both of those things. And I believe that reflects compassion. You'll want to exhibit that as well if you ever come in contact with folks with these issues. And in the end, I think RT exemplifies sound biblical principles, because in the end, God is in it all. Even when somebody, this is what I think, you know, in a sense, yeah, doctor. Let's say medical doctors. You know, they heal cancer, or they heal a broken foot, or what have you. In the end, they're just putting something right as God designed it, and God is the one who created the natural healing of the body. And in the end, He's the great physician. And I know that has to deal with verses of healing sin, but in the end, I believe that God is the great physician, and love is the answer. That may sound trite to you guys. It's not trite. Love really is the answer. But what you mean or do about love is sometimes a different story, because we're all imperfect people and perfect Christians. The ex-gay guy, Jim, walking through the door right now.
Maybe you want to meet him? He's not there. That was a joke. I wanted to see how he reacted. How many felt anxiety? Come on, be honest. How many felt just perfect love for that guy? Be honest if you did. How many of you felt anxiety, fear? What, are you dead?
Anxiety from me calling him out.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I got a kind of an energy hit here. I don't want to sound too California, but I got the feeling like you guys just went, huh? So if I'm right, it's okay. If I'm wrong, it's all right too. But one of the main reasons why I'm saying that is because you may experience that in your all of our generations, but especially you guys. You just wait for the night or the day when somebody finally gains the courage to walk down the aisle and comes forward to be baptized or to repent of homosexual sins. What are you going to do? We're going to talk more about that Sunday, but what are you going to do? How are you going to... Huh?
Rejoice.
Rejoice, right. But what are you going to do specifically?
Hopefully go up and embrace
him. Yeah, now you're talking. Yeah. Is it going to be, well, so glad for you. Take care now. That's what he's afraid of. It's exactly what he's afraid of. Being left alone, abandoned. I won't go into it because we are going to talk more about this later, but I'll talk more specifically about specific ways adolescents, teenagers, college guys, fathers, mothers, members of the church can actually literally assist in a spiritual, emotional way that really will help tremendously the things he's working on. Yes, sir. Yes. So the question for you guys is, how are you going to get to that point of activism or heart? How are you going to do that? Are you going to be sensitive to God? Or are you going to follow the old, I'm just going to say it, forgive me if I step on toes, the old Church of Christ handshake and a great, how you doing? Thank you. Yeah, that's how you do it. One of the many ways, and we'll talk more about that tomorrow. Does somebody else have a... Yeah. Great. All right. Set your mind on things above, the mind of Christ, which is exactly a lead into what you just said. So thank you. There is some, just you know, because we're talking about how things change actually, there are a lot of churches in the country that deal with these issues with 12-step programs. In my experience, for behaviors, they can do real well with 12-step programs. Behaviorally, it really helps some people deal with these issues. However, for me, in my experience, that's only half the job. If a guy's not really dealing with his gender identity inferiority, he's not really dealing with the unmet emotional needs, or possibly if he was sexually abused, it's going to keep this cycle year after year after year. Some guys can take that. Some guys can't at all. The roadblocks. We've already really talked about that. The roadblocks, as you all know, as I've said earlier, are just kids that get drawn into the world. And it's you're now beginning to live your lives more fully as you grow into adulthood. And I'm so sorry to say that your lives are going to be inundated with gender and sexual issues as never before. Think about this for a minute. The whole gay marriage issue. As far as we know in recorded history, not ever in history, never in history, even considering the Greco-Roman times, has homosexuality ever risen to the status of marriage until now. I don't know if God will do anything about it or not, because I've never seen that. It's nowhere. Maybe some pockets are. There's no nation that's ever vaulted homosexuality to that status. I'm kind of afraid for you. So that's another reason why I'm here, is so that you guys have what I hope you can see is the truth, and you can deal with it with that strong truth, but also deal with it in the Christ-like compassion that God compels you to use. So to fit you with how it's done, to fit you with knowledge, to help you really get a handle on some of this stuff and be able, ultimately, of course, to influence people and help to save people's souls. I'm just happy to be here to help you do that. Because I got to tell you, I'll tell you this. You, in my experience, you already know, more than most people know in the entire world about these issues. Because this world, until this explosion of homosexuality and transgenderism, has remained under the radar, in essence. It's remained secretive, shamed, repressed, suppressed. We haven't been dealing with it. It's all the way down here, and now it's exploded. And like it or not, you're going to have to deal with it. And I hope I've given you some tools to know at least where to go and how to deal with it. And we'll talk much more about it later on. So any other questions? Yes, sir.
I think there's several reasons. One of them is that, which is true, this is such an off-design issue. When you start dealing with how men see, or women see themselves in their core identity, and you start questioning that, it makes people really nervous. Because they've never thought about identity. Like some of you here, which would be common if so, might be thinking, what's the hard thing about masculinity? I don't get it. How could a guy not feel masculine? Okay, and to talk about that kind of puts them off center. And for some, I think it makes them doubt their own sense of masculinity. And so we as guys, we tend to believe in the hyper macho kind of version of masculine identity. I could go on for another sermon about that one, but it's this. Little boys often do that, by the way. When they see a guy who's a little boy who's a 5-year-old and he's kind of more like his mother, that's sometimes when the bullying starts. And that bullying is all about the bully who feels insecure about his own sense of masculinity. Because what's supposed to be happening in those early years is that he doesn't know this. It's all unconscious processes. But he's building up his own, he wants to be with the boys and building up his own sense of masculinity. And then here's this guy who he's a guy, but he sounds a little bit like a girl and they can't stand it. And so they just For some guys who are demonstrative, at least, they either shame him or they beat him. But that's all about them. And so I think some of those grown-up attitudes still exist, and so we just kind of don't want to deal with it. There's another reason, though, I think. This is just what I think. I think that sometimes the church doesn't know the difference between shame and guilt. And I've just expressed what I believe about that. We tend to think, the reason why I know this is because these guys tell me this in my office. Tens, hundreds of guys, all right? They think that it's actually a good thing to shame themselves into righteousness. So they will hurt themselves to make them be righteous. Does that sound biblical to you? Would it really help you for me to walk up to you and say, you know what, you got, brother, you're going to hell, and you got to stop this behavior right now, and you're an idiot if you don't do that? Would that help you? No.
Sorry to put you on the spot there. I don't even know him.
I mean, you see what I'm saying? We tend to, without realizing it, cross our emotional and spiritual boundaries, and we end up being judgmental, which is God doesn't like, for sure. And we mistake being hard on the issues, and it comes across as shaming. Who are you going to convert with shame? Did Christ ever use shame on people? The only people I know, I think I'm correct on this, some of you correct me if I'm wrong, the only people he actually shamed, because they deserved it evidently, were the Pharisees. Who? How did he treat all the other people? Woman caught in adultery, what did he do? You know the answer to that. What did he do when Lazarus was buried? He knew he could have raised him again, but he was crying. I see a message of hope and love and all this stuff, and it applies to these issues as well as all the other issues as well. Certainly race. This is a great double thing here today. They really fit each other so well. So you got to understand what you mean by shame and how you react to people.
It almost sounds like the shame-based version of the law, and it sounds like Old Testament mentality instead of New Testament mentality, in which there are consequences, eternal consequences for sin, no doubt about it. But there's much more about the healing power of Christ through love and actual forgiveness so that you are sanctified. That stuff didn't go on in the Old Testament. So I think we're back there. Does that answer your question? Okay, anything? Yes, sir? One more question we're going to have to stop.
Do you think we're maybe influenced by the world around us, too?
Oh, yes.
That in the world there are some sins that are acceptable and some that aren't acceptable. So probably the issue before women is glorified, but so you know, maybe the church of the world glorifies the world, and the world draws back from it.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And that's kind of an off-base, biased mentality. We're not perfect, and I think we get into trouble when we get into that area. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've learned something, and I think we're going to lunch.